Thanks, and thanks to the organizers for the invitation and for putting together this conference. So I'll be talking about some joint work with Matthias Aschenbrenner. And Tom Scanlon. And it will be about the structure of strongly minimal groups definable in the theory of compact complex manifolds. So I'll start with some a brief reminder of the model theoretic setup for this. So we're interested in compact complex manifolds. We want to study the model theoretically. I'll usually abbreviate this as CCM. In fact, one can work more generally, we will, with compact complex spaces. So we won't require the smoothness condition on the manifold. The singularities are allowed, but it won't play, at least on the face of it, a very relevant role in what I will say. So if you like, you can restrict attention to compact complex manifolds. And we want to study the analytic subsets of these. So I remind you that a subset is complex analytic. I'll just say analytic. If at every point in the space there's a neighborhood, U and holomorphic functions on U, finitely many, such that in this neighborhood U, our set is given by the vanishing of these holomorphic functions. So locally, at every point in the manifold, these sets look like R, the zeros of holomorphic functions. And we make this into a structure in the following way. It's convenient, in fact, to work with all the spaces at once. So we consider many-sorted structure. Script A, where we have a sort for each compact complex space. So we just look at the whole category, and we consider each compact complex space as a sort, and then we have predicates for all the analytic sets. So predicates PA for all A analytic subsets of finite Cartesian powers of sort, so the MIs are sorts, they're compact complex spaces. So this is the language in which we want to work. So I guess the main thing to observe about the setup is that you know, the local data defining these analytic sets are not definable in our structure. So these holomorphic functions, locally defined holomorphic functions, are not definable in our structure. It's just the set themselves that are named. So we just name the predicates for the sets, forgetting about the way A was built up from holomorphic functions. And this imposes on all these Cartesian products a topology coming from the analytic sets, which we call the Zariski topology. Just some notation, I guess, where Zariski closed just means analytic, complex analytic. So in analogy with the algebraic subsets of a complex algebraic variety. And this topology is notarian, since we're working in the compact case, working with compact spaces. And the basic fact, which says that this structure has a nice model theory, is due to Zilber. It's a well-behaved model theory, is that the theory has quantifier elimination. So every definable set will be a finite Boolean combination of these analytic sets, and is a finite Mori rank. Sort by sort, of course. Each sort is a finite Mordirik. Okay, so whenever you have a theory of finite Morley rank, and you're trying to study the structure of definable sets in the theory, a key step is to understand the groups definable in this theory, and for that, the strongly minimal groups are are an important step, and that's the kind of question I'll be talking about today. So to describe the strongly minimal groups definable in this theory, or interpretable in the theory. In fact, the theory admits elimination of imaginaries. This is why, in fact, one has to work with compact-complex spaces and not just manifolds, for example. And so interpretable is just definable. So we're interested in strongly minimal groups definable in this theory, which means, of course, given a model of the theory, well, so this will be an elementary extension of A. Notice that every point of the standard model is named because it's an analytic subset. So there's a predicate for every point. So a model of this theory is an elementary extension. And the question is, or the task, is to describe strongly minimal groups definable in this model. So this was done for the standard model by Anand Pillay and Tom Scanlon. It follows from a theorem of theirs, and I will come to this in a minute and state it precisely. But so our work is to extend this description of strongly minimal groups definable in the standard model A itself to elementary extensions. Okay. Okay. Well, so what? Let me point out first of all what some of the strongly minimal groups are. I mean, so we have working in the standard model, we have the projective complex line. This is a sort in A. It's a compact complex manifold. And in it, we have the complex field definable. And in fact, the induced structure on the complex numbers is just the pure field. And this is a consequence of Chow's theorem and quantified elimination. Right? Because yes, Chow's theorem says that any analytic subset of projective space is in fact algebraic. So if it's given locally by holomorphic functions, it's given globally by homogeneous polynomials. So that means that the structure induced from the whole structure on the complex numbers, which lives definably in our structure, is just the pure field. So we have all algebraic groups definable. All algebraic groups for complex numbers are definable. Well, in fact, maybe it makes sense to work in the elementary extension at this point. So we have some elementary extension. You have the complex numbers, and you have correspondingly an algebraically closed field definable in the elementary extension, just the interpretation of the complex numbers. So this will be an elementary extension of the complex numbers. So this is there is a field, an algebraic closed field given to us, and so all algebraic groups over this algebraic closed field are definable in A prime, and so this we have the strongly minimal algebraic groups. Right? And the strongly minimal algebraic groups are just the dimension 1, so we get the strongly minimal algebraic groups, namely, what are the one-dimensional algebraic groups, the additive group, multiplicative group, and also elliptic curves over. So this is the additive group of this field, multiplicative group of this field, elliptic curves over this field. Okay. So really, the question is, what are the strongly minimal groups that are not algebraic? What other strongly minimal groups are definable in this structure? Okay. Well, let's start in the standard model. So let's look in A. What other kinds of groups can we define? Natural class are the compact ones. So the compact, every compact complex Lie group is definable. So I'm working right now on the standard model. I'll pass to the elementary extension in a bit. I want to state what one knows about the standard model. So a compact complex Lie group, it's a compact complex manifold with holomorphic group structure, so it's particularly definable. And all of these look like, these are all obtained as complex tori, so they're of the form Cn model lattice. And of course you get some algebraic ones this way. For example, all abelian varieties are algebraic groups, but are also complex tori. But you can also get ones that are not algebraic. In fact, you can get ones that are strongly minimal and not algebraic. So it's just a fact that if this is chosen sufficiently generally, then T is strongly minimal. So T is a compact complex manifold, inherits holomorphic group structure from Cn. And in many cases, in the general case, you actually obtain something that is strongly minimal. So we have these candidates of strongly minimal groups definable in our structure, which are not algebraic. So these are not algebraic if n is bigger than 1. If n is equal to 1, then this is an elliptic curve. So that was taken care of. But for n bigger than 1, these aren't algebraic because they're not one-dimensional, right? So the only strongly minimal algebraic groups are the one-dimensional ones. But here we have n-dimensional strongly minimal. So Morley rank 1, but dimension n. So Morley rank is bounded by dimension, but not always equal to it. So you can obtain strongly minimal n-dimensional groups, definable groups. And the theorem I alluded to before, Pillay and Scanlon, says these are the only non-algebraic ones, so the only ones that are not algebraic. So the theorem Scanlon is just that if G is a strongly minimal definable group in the standard model, then G is, well, definably isomorphic to, well, either, as we mentioned, there was GA and GM. There were also elliptic curves. And then there's the ones coming from this procedure, so strongly minimal complex tori. Well, so to exclude this case, I'll say dimension bigger than 1. So we have the algebraic ones and the ones that are not algebraic, and these are the only ones, is what the theorem says. In fact, maybe the right way to view the separation here is between these. So these are the complex tori, and these are the linear algebraic. So everything is either a linear algebraic group or a strongly minimal complex tori. So this is, in fact, a consequence of a more general theorem, the first step in a more general theorem of Pillay and Scanlon, which actually describes the structure of any definable group as a extension of a complex torus by a linear algebraic group. So it's like the Chevalier theorem in the case of algebraic groups, generalized to this context of compact complex manifolds. And so in particular, for strongly minimal, it's one or the other. Okay. So this is the theorem that we're trying to generalize. So I won't write down precisely our statement about the non-standard models yet. Instead, I'll try to start proving it, and then at some point, statement will come up. But maybe I'll start stating it just to set up notation. So we want to work in an elementary extension, and we have, let's say, G tilde strongly minimal group definable in A prime, then G tilde is, well, the first possibility is what I already talked about, linear algebraic groups over the corresponding algebraically closed field. And then I'll leave 2 blank. This is going to be the analog of being a complex torus in the standard model. And we'll see what it says eventually. Okay. Oh, maybe I should. So how would we start studying groups definable in elementary extensions? Well, of course, so to but usual model theoretic methods, to study an elementary extension is to study the standard model with uniformity. Right? So one has this sort of general picture. Maybe I'll put it here. I mean, well, right, if this is your standard model, this is the elementary extension, you have your G tilde definable in the elementary extensions, defined over some parameter C, say. Then by taking the locus of C in the standard model, by taking the smallest analytic set in the standard model, which contains C in the elementary extension, which exists by the notarianity, this parameter corresponds to an analytic set in the standard model. And then varying these parameters inside the formulas defining G tilde, you get a family of definable groups, right, in the standard model. And the way one, well, one way to try and study something happening here, a definable group up here, is to look at families of definable groups in the standard model and try to prove things uniformly. If you can prove them uniformly, they'll hold also for the generic fiber of these families. So in fact, the way I'll do this is I won't work in the standard model. I'll just work with some definable group in A, and I'll keep track of uniformity. So G, I'll write it here, it's a definable group A. And I want to basically prove this theorem but keep track of uniformity, and various subtleties arise in doing this. Well, the first thing is that it's not necessarily the case, as one might initially expect, that because we started with something strongly minimal, that you get a family of strongly minimal groups. In other words, strong minimality is not definable. Morley rank is not definable. There's an example due to Lieberman and studied by Pillay and Scanlon, which shows that there exist families of definable groups where each, in the standard model, where each member, so uniformly definable families of definable groups, where each member of this family is two-dimensional, in fact, a product of a fixed elliptic curve, so a two-dimensional abelian variety, but the generic fiber is strongly minimal. So if you want to try and use this method and study things uniformly here, even if you start with something strongly minimal, I can't assume that G here is strongly minimal. But what does descend? Some things are definable properties. For example, the fact that every strongly minimal group is commutative, so you get that we can assume that the definable group we're studying in the standard model is commutative, at least, because that's true here, and that is a definable property, which will then be true in the family. The second problem, the initial problem, is that these are given to us in the definable category. Right? So G is just, even though I've sort of drawn it here as sort of a geometric thing, it's only a constructible thing. So it's not given to us as a as a Zariski open subset of a compact complex manifold. It could have some constructible decomposition. But we may want to, right? So it's not, this thing could have several pieces living in different sorts and so on. It's not geometric, it's constructible somehow because it's in the definable category. Of course, it's strongly minimal, so a very large piece of it will be, right? So by quantifier elimination, this will look like some open set. So minus finitely many points, it will be a Zariski open subset of a compact complex manifold, or a non-standard of a Zariski closed set in the elementary extension. And then there'll be finitely more other pieces. And that, again, is a definable fact, which transfers to the family. So I can assume that these commutative definable groups I have are of the form U union F, where U contained in X is Zariski open. So it's a complement of an analytic set. X is a compact complex manifold, and F is finite. I can always achieve this because I'm starting, the G tilde I have in mind is strongly minimal. OK, so the first task is to correct this problem, right, to make this a geometric thing. in other words, to somehow, after taking a definable transformation, definable isomorphism of G, to witness it as a Zariski open subset of a compact complex manifold, so that it is a geometric object. And I won't actually prove this compactification. I'll state it in a minute. But let me give an idea of what could go wrong by going the other way. Suppose you started with a definable group which was a Zariski open subset. Right? So for example, suppose you started with a linear algebraic group, lives as a Zariski open subset in some algebraic variety. Or maybe you started with a complex torus and it was already compact. Yeah? So you already had it witnessed as a compact complex Lie group. How could you mess things up? I mean, it's pretty straightforward that definably you can sort of mess up the presentation. Right? So I mean, so suppose you were given say Y, some compact complex manifold. So this is in the standard model. And you have some analytic set, you know, and H. Well, this is what I'm going to say doesn't have anything to do with groups. So it's just to do with definability and so on. So H is just, let's say, a Zariski open subset of Y. So you have some Zariski open subset of Y. How could you mess it up so it doesn't look like a Zariski open subset? Well, you can do definably. Well, you can do things like you can choose a point. So this is omitted, right? So H is Y take away this boundary, this analytic set. Now take any point, say F in H, and take it out and, you know, put it somewhere else, right? I mean, somewhere else in your model, just choose any point, F prime, somewhere else in your model. And then, you know, this is maybe a silly thing to do, but you can, of course, look at your H definably isomorphically as this, right? Where the group operation F prime just acts like F. So definably you can do things like this, and now your if this was a group, but now your set is no longer given to you as a Zariski open set. Of course, this is no problem. You could transform it back by just moving the F prime back to F, and you would recover your original geometric setting. But you could do something a little bit worse. You could blow up this point F. So now you have X. It looks almost the same as Y. Still has this this boundary thing, though somehow the shape changed, but wasn't supposed to. This point gets replaced. You blow it up, and it gets replaced by an analytic subset, a copy of, say, the projective line. Right? So you can do this. You have a point, and you can just blow up this point and get another compact complex manifold, where now the point is replaced by an actual line. And U is now what H becomes, right? U is what H becomes. And now you can witness your set G as U union this point F prime. Okay, so it's given to you as a Zariski open subset of X together with another point, but it's not a matter of just putting this F prime back into X, because you can't. It was replaced by something of higher dimension. So how would you recover your H from this data? So this is, of course, definably the same as the H you started with. U is definably the same as H take away F. How would you do it? Well, you somehow need to detect, looking at these analytic sets, you need to detect which one you need to collapse, which one was a genuine boundary from here, and which one was one that was blown up. And then you collapse it, and then you take your F back to F prime. This would be how you would recover it, right? Roughly speaking, right? So, the compactification lemma that I'll write down now says that, in fact, this is more or less the only way you can mess up H. If you started, in this discussion, I didn't use the fact that this was a group, but if you started with a definable group, this is more or less the only way you could have messed up the presentation of your set G. So, we're in this context. We have G is equal to U union F, right? So that's the notation up there. This was an aside. We have our definable group G. It's given to us as a Zariski open subset of some X together with some finite set of points. And the lemma is that there is a compactification. There is a definable embedding into a CCM Y such that iota of G is Zariski open in Y. So this is this process of recovering the H. But in fact, one knows more. The lemma gives you more. It gives you that, so we had this X and G. There was a large open subset of G. G was just U together with a finite set of other points. U was a subset of X. we have this embedding iota, but in fact, you get a kind of blowdown map. So pi here is a surjective holomorphic map, which on U is the same as iota. And off the finite set of points, so off iota of f, is an isomorphism. So you can always rewrite your definable group G as a Zariski open subset of a compact complex manifold in such a way that the compactification came in this way. You took more or less did something like this. There were certain Zariski closed subsets of X that you had to collapse to give you the points in F, but on U you didn't do anything. So this is what the lemma says. I won't prove it. It's elementary, but it's a bit long. Maybe technical to write down. Okay, but I said I wanted to do things uniformly, and this is exactly not uniform. I mean, this is the construction here deals the construction of this y in the compactification iota is happens in the underlying Euclidean topology, which is not definable in our structure. So this is. Let's go. So the problem is that this is not uniform. So what is not uniform? This embedding of G into Y. The Y and the embedding are not uniform. At least not by the proof of this lemma is not uniform. Our proof of this lemma is not uniform. So by the way, the proof of this lemma comes from the idea is already in the original paper of Pillay and Scanlon of how to do this. Okay. So how do we repair? So we can't do this uniformly, so this doesn't tell us something about a compactification of G tilde in the non-standard model. But in fact, what Pillay and Scanlon prove in their paper, and this is the main step, is that more is true. There's more happening in this lemma, namely G, so the group operation on G extends to each component of the boundary in this compactification. So of Y takeaway boundary. So if you like, identify G and iota of G. It's living inside. It's a Zariski open subset of the CCM Y. You look at the boundary. It has finitely many irreducible components. So what I mean by this is if you take any element of G and you let tau G from G to G be translation by G, this is a definable map. Then this extends, this extends, well, not holomorphically, but meromorphically, to a map, I'll also call it tau G, from C to C, where C is any irreducible component of this boundary. So you have on iota of G this translation map. It's a holomorphic map on iota of G. And it extends to every component of this boundary, maybe not holomorphically, but meromorphically. So on a Zariski open subset of C, it's a holomorphic map. This is somehow a special property. And one uses here, you don't use strong minimality. In fact, we're not assuming this about G, but you do use the fact that it's a commutative algebraic group. Okay. So why does this help? It's still not uniform. We're still talking about this boundary on Y, but now we just lift it. Right? We just lift it from Y to X. So this action actually lifts to X. So this action of G on iota of G lifts to X takeaway. Well, it lifts to what? It lifts to pi inverse of Y iota of G. And pi is an isomorphism off the finite set iota of F. So on Y takeaway G, F is contained in G. So on Y takeaway G, it's an isomorphism. So this is just a copy of Y takeaway G in X. In fact, it'll end in x take away u. So we now have an action of g. So the point in all this is to somehow forget about the bottom half of the diamond there. We want to just work with the u, the x, and the g. The problem with the y is it's not uniformly definable. So we're trying to see how much information is uniformly definable. But we get this action on some components of x. And this is uniformly definable. So the difference between compact and non-compact is the difference between whether iota is surjective or not. Right? This is the compactification. If g actually was, say, a complex torus, then iota would be surjective. So it's the question of whether y take away g is empty or not. But you can translate this in the following possibilities. So there's two cases. One, g, so I'm going to say this in a way that should look uniformly definable, g acts on some component of x take away u. And case two is not this. It does not act on any component. And this is a uniform, this distinction is uniformly definable. It's not hard to check and to see that whether or not your group operation extends to something meromorphic on some irreducible component or not is a definable thing. And there's no reference to y or the compactification here. This is now something just about g, u, and x. Though, of course, it comes from this y. Right, so these are the two possibilities. And now, we're in business. This is uniformly definable. So we have to see what the implications of the two possibilities are. Well, clearly, what's the implication of two? If it doesn't act on any component, well, I mean, I just said in the line above that it does act on the preimage of y take away g. So that just says that iota of g equals y. So two clearly implies that it must be the case that iota of g is equal to y. Namely, g is definably isomorphic to a complex to a compact complex Lie group. It's actually compact. It was just one of these cases where you started with a complex torus, you removed a point, maybe you blew up that point, and now we've just undone it with iota, and you return to something that's compact. Okay, but of course, maybe the better way to write this is that iota from g to y is an isomorphism, but these isomorphisms are not uniformly definable still. Right? So this is a conclusion of two, but it's not a conclusion we can draw about, at least not from this proof, about g tilde and the elementary extension. But what we can draw, the conclusion, is that if you compose pi with iota inverse, iota is now an isomorphism. So you go from x to y back to g. You get a map from x to g. This is iota inverse composed with pi, which is a surjective holomorphic map. Now, holomorphic doesn't make sense because g was, so I'm cheating here. G was given to us, remember, the difference between g and y is g is this constructible representation, y is this geometric representation. And I am exactly not, I mean, I'm not allowed to take this geometric representation, so I have to think about g. So what does it mean for this map to be holomorphic? Well, this is a definable group. So using u, for example, you can define charts on g, and it has a structure of intrinsically, it has a structure of a definable manifold, definable group manifold. So this does have some complex manifold structure, and it makes sense. So this is with respect to the definable group manifold structure. On G. And these maps are uniformly definable. So it's a bit strange. I can detect when something is compact or not, but I can't detect its compactification. I mean, however, I can detect the surjective. Now, of course, in the standard model, if you're the holomorphic image of a compact complex manifold and you're a complex Lie group, then you're a compact complex Lie group. Right, but I mean, this doesn't make sense in the elementary extension. So this is actually equivalent to this statement, but this one is definable. And so this is what is uniform, and that gives us our number two here. I don't know if this is the best place to write it. So number one was linear algebraic groups over C, and number two is exactly this. There exists a holomorphic surjection, F from some X tilde to my strongly minimal group G tilde, where X tilde is a Zariski closed set in the elementary extension. So this is the analog of being compact for us. It's a holomorphic image of a closed thing inside a compact complex manifold in the non-standard sense, working in the elementary extension. That's all we are able to translate. So part of the open question around here is, can you do a bit better? Can you actually witness these isomorphisms uniformly? Maybe at the end I'll say some equivalent versions of two that might describe why this is, might give better motivation why this is maybe a good enough statement or very close to being the right analog. Okay, but I haven't proved the theorem. I've just proved that case two, when there's no action, implies this. So I need to show that case one implies one. So that's what I'll do now. Right, so I'll leave, I'll leave this. Okay. Right, so we've shown that case one and two are uniformly definable. So it makes sense to ask whether they're true of G tilde. And when case two is true of G tilde, we get this situation, the non-standard compact situation. And case one, we want to show that we get a linear algebraic group. Yeah. What is the what? Condition on X? So Zariski closed in the elementary extension, which means that it's the generic fiber. So it means that X tilde, so you have some analytic family of analytic sets in the standard model, and X tilde is a generic fiber of this analytic family. So the Zariski topology on the standard model gives you a topology on the elementary extension by just looking at families and plugging in parameters that are in the extension. And holomorphic again, yeah. So this is, yeah. So I'm sorry, this is with respect to the, now non-standard definable manifold structure on G. So G tilde is a definable group. So this is like these, the Weibull, Banerjee's, Wyschowski theorem that Udi mentioned yesterday about how when you have a definable group in this category, you can give it this definable manifold structure, and it's equivalent in over algebraic closed fields, you get the category of algebraic groups. In this structure, you get the category of meromorphic groups, and I've been avoiding the word meromorphic because I haven't defined it, but it's a complex Lie group that's definably a complex Lie group, where you have definable charts and so on. You can make sense of this. So there's an analog of algebraic group in this context, and the right analog is not complex Lie groups, but meromorphic groups. So complex Lie groups that are somehow definable. So this has, and this works in the non-standard model as well. So there's a non-standard, it's not a manifold in standard sense, but there is a, it's covered by things that come from, so if you want to think about this just in terms of the standard model, it's just saying, so in terms of the standard model, it's saying G tilde is the generic fiber of some family of groups. I should give it a name, maybe G bar. It's a family of groups. So each fiber here is a family of groups. G tilde is a generic fiber. So now this is just in the standard model. And I have some X bar, which is a compact complex manifold with a holomorphic surjection, right, to S. And this F, maybe I should call it F little tilde, is just the generic. It's the generic, you apply this map to the generic fibers. And this is holomorphic. So you can restate this entirely in terms of families downstairs. Of course, downstairs, it means that each fiber here is a compact complex Lie group. So this, another way of saying this is just that this comes from a uniformly definable family of compact complex Lie groups. That's what number two says, that G tilde comes as the generic fiber of a uniformly definable family of complex tori, but these things are not uniformly definably complex tori. Each one is individually definably isomorphic to complex tori, but they're not, so there is something there. Otherwise, I would actually get an isomorphism with something compact. Is that... Okay. So what about case one? Well, what does one imply if there is an action? Well, this is going to imply a linear algebraic group. So this is, again, in the standard model. And I'm just going to do it uniformly. And this is really an argument essentially due to Fujiki, which is maybe somewhat standard. And in fact, this case is easier because the uniformity is, there's more machinery involved in proving this in the standard model. But then things can be done uniformly more easily. I mean, using all this machinery, it's more clear that this argument is uniform. So let me, I'm basically giving the argument here in the standard model. What is the argument? Well, I'll just sketch the argument. So what does this say? This is case one. There is an action. So we have this component of x take away u, and we have g acting on c. So the first fact is that, so g acts on c. This is an irreducible component. And g acts on c, by which I mean what I wrote before, that translation by an element extends to a meromorphic map from c to c. So the first step is that, in fact, g acts trivially on c. So tau g, so if you take a g and g, and you look at translation from g to g, it extends to the identity. I'm writing restricts, but I guess I mean extend from c to c. And it acts as the identity. You just fix all the points. This is the first step. And this comes from the strong minimality assumption on the generic fiber. So the reason is that g, so the dimension, first of all, the dimension of c is strictly less than the dimension of g, which is equal to the dimension of x. Right? G is essentially x. I mean, g is essentially a Zariski open subset of x. So these dimensions are the same. This is on the boundary, so it's strictly smaller complex dimension. On the other hand, g tilde was strongly minimal. and so the generic type of g is orthogonal to the generic type of c. So there can't be any interaction. So if there is an action of g on c, it can only be the trivial one. This is an argument in the Pillay-Scanlon paper. It works here as well. This is how you get that this action is trivial. Okay? Because it's acting on something very small. And there can't be any relationships because a strong minimality, any relationship would be witnessed by some algebraic finite to finite relationship, but then the dimensions would have to be the same. But these dimensions are strictly smaller, so there can be no interaction between G and C, except of course the trivial one. So the first thing is that knowing that it acts on the boundary just gives you a fixed point, right? So there's some point C and X such that for all G and G, tau G restricted. I don't know, maybe this is extended to C, takes this point to itself. It fixes a point on this complex manifold, this tau G action. So it's just sort of strange, right? Because this is translation by G. So it moves things around a lot on U, but somehow when you extend it to the boundary, it fixes a point. Okay. So that's the first step. Second step in this argument is just using the conclusion here. Now we know that we have this action of g extends to some point and it fixes the point. Well, for each n, it then acts naturally on the nth infinitesimal neighborhood of this point c in x. So for each n, tau g acts on the nth infinitesimal neighborhood, I'll write it this way, of x at c. What is this? As a complex space, so this is this Grothendieck infinitesimal neighborhood. You could use other formulations, but we use this one. So it's the reduced complex space whose underlying set is just the singleton C. That's all it is as a set, but it has a non-reduced structure sheaf. Namely, you take the local ring, you mod out maximal ideal power n plus 1. You're looking at C, you're looking at how C sits in X, and you're looking at it up to nth order for each n. So since tau g fixes the point c, it acts on these nth infinitesimal neighborhoods. And moreover, it induces an automorphism of these objects. Because it'll have tau minus g, at least generically, it induces an automorphism because it'll have tau minus g as its inverse, right? Tau g and tau minus g are inverses on u because they're translation by g and minus g. So wherever they're defined, they have to be inverses to each other. In particular, they're inverses to each other on this infinitesimal neighborhood as well. And another fact is that it separates points, which I mean for sufficiently large n, capital N, if tau g, if it's what it induces on this nth infinitesimal neighborhood agrees with what tau chi and tau h induces, on this infinitesimal neighborhood, then g has to equal h. And the reason is, by omega 1 compactness, we get this bound n. So the point is, suppose they agreed on all infinitesimal neighborhoods, right? So for up to nth order for all n, they look the same, then they in fact are the same. Then tau g would equal tau h. But this is translation by g and h on an open set. So the only way they can be equal is if g is equal to h. Right? So this is, right, you capture the behavior of tau g by looking at its behavior just at a point, but for infinite order. And then a compactness argument gives you a finite bound, n. So you only have to look up to nth order. And so what you get is a map from g to, well, because it separates points, it'll be an injective map to the automorphism group of xc. And it requires an argument, and this uses some machinery, that this is actually a definable map. What is this? This is a linear algebraic group. It's a group of transformations of this vector space, finite dimensional complex vector space. This is an algebraic. The automorphisms of the infinitesimal neighborhood are algebraic group. And so what's the map? It takes g to, you look at tau g, and you look at what it does at the infinitesimal neighborhood of xc. And so you get a definable embedding into a linear algebraic group. And so g is linear algebraic. Now, I did this not uniformly, but the point is these arguments work uniformly. Namely, these infinitesimal neighborhoods can be defined uniformly. They are, in Grothendieck, for example, defined for the relative situation. So the infinitesimal neighborhoods are given uniformly. Automorphism groups are given uniformly. And these definable maps are given uniformly. So it doesn't follow from here, but it works uniformly. And so we get that 1 implies this. 2, we already pointed out, implies this. So if there is an action, your group must be a linear algebraic group by this kind of argument. OK, I'll just say then let me state what an equivalent, so now looking at this theorem, two, let me say, just point out for people another equivalent forms of the statement of two. I've already done one equivalent form here. So two can be stated as saying that the strongly minimal definable group G tilde comes from a family of definable groups, each of which is definably isomorphic to a complex torus. So you can restate it in terms of uniform families in the standard model, but you can also uniform it, so 2, you can also express it in terms of 2 prime. another way, if you interpret G in an elementary extension of Rn. So compact complex manifolds are interpretable in Rn, all the information identifying C with R2. So this is in the sense of the work of Kobe and Sergey. The compact complex manifolds are interpretable in Rn. and this is living in an elementary extension. And we can interpret G back into an elementary extension of Rn. It lives in some natural case in some elementary extension of Rn, say R prime. So what is the advantage of doing this? The problem with making a clear statement here was that what we really wanted to say is that G tilde is compact. But this doesn't somehow make sense in our setting, because all you have is Zariski topology. We wanted to be compact in the Euclidean topology, but this is a non-standard model. There is no underlying Euclidean topology. But when you interpret it here, there is a natural underlying Euclidean topology coming from the real closed field extension here. So it makes sense to actually talk about manifolds in their setting, in the Rn setting. So this actually becomes a definable manifold in this setting. And as a definable manifold, in this structure, G is definably compact. That's what 2 says. I'm not 100% sure of the equivalence. I shouldn't. I mean, it implies. I'm just trying to show that this is another way of seeing that this is a strong statement. It approaches compactness, and it says that it's definably compact in the only natural setting one can think of where it makes sense to talk about this thing is an actual Euclidean manifold, in some sense. Well, a manifold with, underlying Euclidean structure. right. So I'll stop now.
questions?
Yeah.
It seems like one thing you were able to get is to separate the compact and the non-compact definably in CCM.
Yes.
Do you think in general that if you have uniform family in CCM or definable manifold, all the manifolds are given in CCM, you can separate the compact and the non-compact?
Well, this argument definitely uses the fact that the manifolds are given to us. Well, it uses two things. It uses, first of all, the definable set is, except for a finite set of points, actually already has a risky open subset of X. So it's in this compactification, we use very much that we just have to deal with a finite set of points. So that won't be true. And the other thing it uses is that this has a definable manifold structure coming from the fact that it was a group. So both of these things we wouldn't have. So
assume it is definably given in CCM.
Right. Then can you? I don't think. I mean, yeah, I don't know. But this argument, as I say, you would have to do this compact. So if you had it given in charts as definable manifolds, you could, by elimination imaginaries, exhibit it as definable sets explicitly, and then you'd want to try and actually embed them. I mean, of course, if they were given to you as risky open subsets, then you could just check whether they're equal to their, you know. So your point is that they're given in charts uniformly definable, and then you'd make that into some constructible situation, and now you'd want to embed it back as a Zariski open subset, and this would mean compactifying in general. And I don't know how to do this. I don't know if it's true or not true. Yeah.
Can you describe this term minimal sets? There's nine in the groups.
I guess in principle you can. I mean, the trichotomy is, the problem is the trivial ones, right? So the trivial ones.
Yeah. Do they have any information?
No. I mean, examples, but no information. So this only, this doesn't tell you about the trivial strongly minimal groups, but tells you about the non-trivial ones only.
Any further questions? Thank you.